health products available. Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio. And now, here's Gene Steinberg.
So, you know, I'm the kind of person who always misses UFO sightings. I've said this before. Like, in a situation back in 1976, I was one of the principal sponsors of a UFO convention in or near Valley Forge, Pennsylvania. You know, great historic place. The convention was sort of a success. We only lost $100 on it in 1976 dollars. So what is that today? $10,000 or something. Something like that.
No,
A couple of 300. I'm kidding. Okay, so a few of the people who attended there said, "Did you see the UFO?" I said, "No, I was sitting there losing my shirt on this convention. I hardly had time to worry about UFOs. Didn't see it." Segue to March 13th, 1997. Now, remember, this is something that most of you listeners know about. You know what I'm going to say right now. I lived at the time in Scottsdale, Arizona. This was the birthday of my late brother Wallace. Okay? Doesn't mean anything. He would have been 63 years old had he survived till that date. He died 2 years earlier. Anyway, so on March 13th, 1997, we have the Phoenix Lights. I was home. I was writing books. But I saw no Phoenix Lights. The UFOs again passed me by. Now, we're recording this episode early in November. All right? So, I get a story from one of our listeners, and I'm paging through it right now, about something called the Scottsdale Lights. Now, Scottsdale, Arizona, is a suburb, northeast suburb of Phoenix, Arizona. Okay? And we had something called the Scottsdale Lights, all right? And it just looks like flares or something. This was above a high school football game at the Horizon Huskies. And if you go to the site, something called thepostgame.com, and you look it up, you'll see something flying in the sky, something taken by people who have mobile phones, some lights in the sky. Could be anything, but I didn't see it. Of course, I don't attend high school football games. That's my problem. Why do the UFOs pass me by, Chris? Is this the trickster at work or the anti-trickster?
I don't know, Gene. I think, you know, you just scare them away. If you're outside, they don't appear. When you're inside, that's when they tend to appear. It's just no way around it. I won't touch that one.
No, you do want to touch it, but, you know, very close. But seriously speaking, never happens to me, never see UFOs. My wife has had a couple of psychic-related experiences, and I think she may have seen a UFO at one time, just a light in the sky. Doesn't happen to me. So, Chris O'Brien, you've seen UFOs, though. You're a lucky guy.
We could probably do a whole show on my sightings.
We've mentioned them in passing, but maybe because I'm being the person who's always left out. Tell our listeners quickly, you know, because we only have a couple of minutes and we actually have a real guest today, what you think your most significant sighting was and when it happened.
Well, it's really hard to place any sort of value or significance on them. They all occurred when I least expected them, which the best sightings normally do. They just kind of come out of the blue. Very rarely have I seen things when I'm out looking for them, although I have. Probably the most impressive one that I've seen was about 150 feet away from me. It was a small 12-foot kind of hybrid craft that flew directly in front of the car about 150 feet away, 50 feet off the road.
Hybrid craft.
I wasn't driving.
That?
It looked like it could be, it looked like some retro thing from the Jetsons. That is the only way I can put it.
You saw a tune.
You know,
ladies
I'm not
and gentlemen,
sure. I
this
wasn't
is spectacular.
Driving.
Chris O'Brien, our favorite trickster, my friend, our co-host, saw a tune. You know, did you see Roger Rabbit too?
No. No, it was just like this hybrid. It was a discoidal shape, but it had a slight flare on the back of it, like a small vertical stabilizer. And it zipped right across the road. I mean, at first I thought it was a model airplane of some type. Was the first thing that flashed in my mind, and I thought it was really close to the car. But I noticed it went behind trees that were about 150 feet away before it shot out across the Huerfano Valley, and it really moved weird. It was almost like when you reel in a fishing lure really fast and kind of skips. It kind of skipped like that. It's very hard to describe. It did not look like it was any sort of ballistic, just regular ballistic motion. Since I wasn't driving and it went from left to right, I was able to grab my binoculars and really check it out fairly well out the window. And I figured it was about 12 feet long. And, it was 1 o'clock in the afternoon on a Sunday, beautiful, brilliant, fall day. And that was my first real up-close and personal sighting. And, well, actually my only one that was, within, 200 feet. But I've had others, too. I've had, boomerang-shaped craft that did a falling leaf pattern down into a depression area in the Buck of Grants. That was a daylight sighting. I've had quite a number of silver orbs that hang in the sky. They're fairly high, but low enough so that you could tell the shape. And then they blink out, and then just a few seconds later, they're 20 miles away, and you can barely make them out. So, and the lights in the sky thing, I mean, red lights, orbs, orange, green, huge green fireball I saw.
Listen, ladies and gentlemen,
slowly over the
as Chris says this, I have to tell you, I am insanely jealous. Okay? He sees all these things. He sees orbs.
I was 13 in one sighting.
You were
13 of them in one sighting that I got on night vision videotape.
Okay. Is that posted at your site?
No, but it was just broadcast on the Mysteries of the National Park show on the Travel Channel a couple of weeks back. That's the first time it's been aired. I should probably get that footage up.
Yes, well, we're trying to get your site redesigned. Unfortunately, the person...
And I have some good news for the Paracast listening audience out there. The San Luis Valley Camera Project is back up and running. We're going to have a link to the MUFON Orange County website here within the next couple of days. So by the time this airs, hopefully we'll have an IP address for everybody to go and check out the San Luis Valley Camera Project camera. We're back up online.
Mm. Yeah, that's been a hard thing, a hard nut to crack.
Yeah, and expensive, and it's taken 4 trips up there and back, and it's a lot of work, but we're getting her done.
Oh, we can't wait for that. We'll be mentioning that in the weeks to come as more and more things happen. But today you brought us a guest from Denver, a guy who's written a whole bunch of books, but what is Jeff Danilek going to focus on?
Well, he's written one of the better books that I've seen on the great airship wave of the late 1880s or 1890s. And I think that... that is a very, very intriguing series of events that occurred off and on over about 3 years, 1896. I think the first sightings really started. And then there were sightings all through 1897 into 1898. And then a few years later in New Zealand, there were some similar sightings. So he's done quite a bit of research on this particular sighting wave. And I can't wait to pick his brain a little bit about this and find out where he comes down on the Aurora, Texas, windmill crash and supposed buried aliens in the town cemetery there.
He doesn't mention
Hayden
Hughes.
Talk about a lot of
Remember
cool
Hayden
things.
Hughes? He got a lot of publicity saying that he knew what was actually buried at Aurora, Texas. It didn't come to much, but he made a big spiel over it. This was many, many years ago, but you never heard of him. Anyway, I should also tell you, speaking of getting in touch and all that stuff, if you go to the Paracast at Twitter, you'll find we're there. Yes, we do have a Twitter account. We never mention it very much. The book, by the way, is called The Great Airship of 1897. The guest is Jeff Danilek. He'll be joining us momentarily with Gene. And Chris, you're in
the Paracast.
So here's what happened. I was placing an order online. The site went down. It just stopped responding. It took hours before it returned, but I had already placed the order with another company. If your site goes down, you could lose business. And if you have a business or personal site, you'll want to know it's easy to run and it will stay online. At iWeb, your site is hosted on one of the most reliable networks in the world. Check it out. iWeb.com. That's iWeb.com. Fate Magazine provides true reports of the strange and unknown. Keep up with the latest on angels and miracles, psychic phenomena, ghosts, UFOs, life after death, and much, much more. To receive your free issue of Fate Magazine, call now at 1-800-728-2730 or visit their website at www.fatemag.com. That's 1-800-728-2730. What are you waiting for? Your fate awaits.
Hi, Jason Lewis here. Anybody who's been listening to my program knows how shaky the U.S. economy is right now. Will we have a V-shaped recovery, or will it be a W-shaped one where the nation slips back into recession? Of course, if you think that Washington can spend or inflate its way out of a downturn, you've got nothing to worry about. But as you know, I have my doubts. So let me tell you about gold. Now, as my friend Ted Anderson from Midas Resources likes to say, gold, like all commodity markets, fluctuates in price, and you could lose money. But it has never been worth zero. Give it some thought, and if you're interested in converting your IRA to gold, or would like to actually have it in your possession, call Midas Resources today at 1-800-686-2237. The U.S. dollar was once backed by gold, but has since lost 90% of its value. And if things don't change, I'm afraid the trend will continue. Call Midas Resources today at 1-800-686-2237 for gold and tell them Jason Lewis sent you.
Ready for cold and flu season? Now's the time to get ready and save during the pre-winter sale at HerbalHealer.com. Stock up on powerful, natural flu fighters like olive leaf extract, elderberry power, and grapefruit seed liquid. Don't forget your vitamin D3 this winter. Right now, HerbalHealer.com has 120 soft gels, 1,000 IUs, on sale for only $9. And remember, HerbalHealer.com offers eFoods Global products, delicious, premium, storable foods that contain no MSG, no trans fats, no GMO, and have a 25-year shelf life. Click the eFoods link on HerbalHealer.com and try eFoods storable meals for free. Bookmark HerbalHealer.com, then experience live chat, correspondence courses, and sign up for our free newsletter. As always, new customers get a free 128-page catalog with your order. Log on and hit the pre-winter specials at HerbalHealer.com. Healing the world with nature, one person at a time, since 1988.
Plan a healthy garden easy and fast with OrganicaSeed.com. Easy because OrganicaSeed.com offers one of the largest online selections of organic, heirloom, non-hybrid, and untreated seeds, as well as tobacco and cotton seeds at low prices. Go to OrganicaSeed.com, spelled OrganicaSeed.com. OrganicaSeed.com. Remember, OrganicaSeed is healthy seed.
HempUSA.org has a revolutionary wonder food for detoxing the body and rebuilding the immune system.
Microplant powder can help unclog arteries and soften heart valves while removing heavy metals, virus, fungus, bacteria, and parasites. Plus, it cleans and purifies the blood, lungs, stomach, and colon. Keep your body clean with microplant powder. Visit us at HempUSA.org or call 908-691-2608 today.
We'd like to hear from you. If you have a comment or question about the Paracast, send it to news@theparacast.com. That's news@theparacast.com. And if you'd like to catch up on past episodes, we have hundreds of shows for you to download direct from theparacast.com. That's theparacast.com. Or check us out at iTunes.
We're going back in time to 1897 with Jeff Danilek. And he's a longtime UFO paranormal researcher. He's written quite a number of books. By the way, there's another book that came out of his recently called Phantoms of the Skies, which is the lost history of aviation from antiquity to the Wright brothers. I'm going to ask him about that book because that's also... it's fascinating. But now we'll look at other people who fly or creatures. 1897. Why is that so significant for people just maybe getting into the UFO mystery and trying to figure out what's going on?
Well, 1897 was the first year that we had a UFO flap in this country. A lot of people think it all started in 1947, you know, with the Arnold sighting, but it actually goes back to 1897 when people started seeing unexplained lights in the sky, and it made the press of the day.
One thing I've heard from time to time from skeptics is that the newspapers who carry these stories were kind of playing around just to maybe sell newspapers. You know, few of those people didn't mind doing that.
Well, you know, that probably was a part of that. That certainly was an element of it, especially some of the smaller papers. But if you look at how they worded the articles themselves, they don't really do it in a tongue-in-cheek sort of fashion like you see with the more fun stuff they did. It's reported, for the most part, very seriously. That's not to say people didn't make up stuff, but the way it's reported, it looks like it's a legitimate news story, and that's the way they seem to be covering it.
Was there a specific sighting, as there sometimes are with so-called UFO flaps, that triggered the whole thing?
Yes, actually, it all began in November of 1897 when people in the city of Sacramento saw this light moving across the sky over the city against the breeze, against the wind. And they didn't know what it was. People thought it was a light hanging from beneath a cigar-shaped vessel of some kind, vehicle. And so they started calling it a dirigible or an airship. That was picked up. It was seen a week later over San Francisco and all over the California, Central California area for almost a month and a half. And that was what really triggered the whole thing.
Is it possible it was some kind of balloon or something or dirigible?
Well, the premise of my book, I explore this very idea that this was really some kind of a cutting-edge piece of technology. There's really three alternatives. There's either it's an alien spacecraft, it's all a hoax, or it's a real airship that somebody built. And so I wanted to put the idea out there. What would it take to really build something like this in 1897? Were the materials there? Could you have done it? Could somebody actually have built this thing in secret in California and was test flying it? And that's basically my whole theory, my whole hypothesis, if you will.
Isn't it also true some of those sightings involve airships that landed and pilots who came out saying, hey, you know, I'm perfecting this new aircraft, stay tuned, we'll soon introduce it?
There was a couple of instances in which people claimed that they spoke with the crew members of this airship. It's remarkable how human they were. They were, you know, just run-of-the-mill humans. Sometimes, apparently, a couple of people even got tours inside the vessel. So if things are to be taken as literal truth, it sounds as though we're dealing with a real piece of machinery here and not something extraterrestrial.
Well, this is Chris here, and welcome to the show.
Okay.
I do seem to recall that at the beginning of the wave, there was some talk of an inventor who I think approached the press at some point and had some very enigmatic comments about the airship and how he kind of knew where it was from. And then at the end of the wave, I believe in Massachusetts, there was, I think, an inventor who claimed he was going to have a press conference and do a big unveiling of the thing, which never happened, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the Massachusetts one at the end. However, I am familiar with some of the early press accounts out of California where there was a lawyer, I believe his name was Andrews, who stepped forward and said that he had met the inventor. He had seen the facility where he created the airship, and that he was going to come forward once he'd gotten it perfected. And this guy came out and was very public about it, and then a couple of days later he sort of recanted it as though somebody got to him and said, hey, you need to keep this quiet.
Okay, so is this the early Men in Black?
Not Men in Black. I think it's more of the business partners that were in on this. I think they were trying to keep this quiet, and this guy basically was a braggart. He came out and talked about, hey, I know something no one else knows. And I think they came to him and said, look, you know, you need to keep this quiet until we are ready to go public with it. Otherwise, you know, we're going to get you.
Yeah, the men in Seersucker.
Well, you know, in the book, I premise that the people behind this thing may have been lawyers or a lawyer who was financing this whole thing. You know, in San Francisco, 1897, the gold rush, there was a lot of very wealthy people in the city, and any one of them could have been behind this. And lawyers tend to know other lawyers. They hang out with those people. So if there was a lawyer who was financing it.
At the bottom of the ocean along with the others.
Yeah, all the sharks and stuff, right. It's a possibility that they just said, hey, quiet. Keep this down.
But did any of these so-called stories or claims of an upcoming invention ever come to pass?
No, actually, what happened was these sightings kind of stopped fairly suddenly in mid-December 1897. And then there was nothing really heard for a couple of months. And then in the spring of 1897, in the spring, they started picking up again in the Midwest, as though the inventor was moving his invention further east. He was experimenting with it, doing short hops across the Midwest. And then all of a sudden, about the middle of April, they just stopped again. The premise that I put in the book is that perhaps they met with some sort of a mishap about that time, and the whole venture blew up, essentially, and literally.
In Aurora, Texas, right? They hit a windmill.
Well, no, actually, there was a report out of a newspaper in Kalamazoo, Michigan, in which someone reported seeing an explosion in the sky, the sound of, like, cannon fire. And so it's possible that it went down somewhere over the northern Midwest. The Aurora, Texas sightings and all those sightings in Texas seem to be misplaced from what I could see in my research. They seemed like they were a separate entity or energy about them that were disconnected from the main sightings in the Midwest. So I tend to personally discount a lot of the Texas sightings as being probably frivolous. This was more of a remote area at the time, more of a place that would have been more likely to invent stuff. But you know, it's hard to know what reports are credible and which aren't. Is, you know, how do you really define that?
Right. I just for your own information, in my research in the San Luis Valley for my first book, I happened to my second book, I happened to uncover a small little notice, a little article, one paragraph article in a central Colorado newspaper that referred to an airship sighting that happened near Gunnison, Colorado. And this is the only mention that I can find of anybody seeing these things in the Rocky Mountain region. So we might have to compare notes later, and I might have to shoot that information over to you. I was very surprised to find
that. Well, I'll tell you what, we'll explore many surprises with Jeff Danilek. The 1897 airship mystery or not a mystery with Gene and Chris. You're in
the Paracast.
America's number one source for independent talk radio for over a decade. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Hey, folks, in today's fast-paced work environment, getting everyone in the same room for a meeting can be challenging, especially when they work in different locations. And that's why I use GoToMeeting with HD Faces by Citrix. It is amazing. You can collaborate online by sharing your presentation while seeing colleagues face-to-face in high definition. They can't hide their blemishes. Video quality is so clear and natural, it's like being in the same room. And all you need is an internet connection with a webcam. It's that easy. So here's what I can do. For example, on the Paracast, which I host with my friend Chris O'Brien, we live in different locations. We need to share something, a document or something like that. All I have to do is call him up with GoToMeeting, and I say, Chris, take a look at this, and he said he's ready to go. You can try GoToMeeting with HD Faces free for 30 days. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click the Try It Free button, enter the promo code PODCAST, use the promo code PODCAST.
Jason Lewis here. With the holidays just around the corner, be sure to consider the greatest gift you can give to your friends and family, peace of mind. That's why I choose WiseFoodStorage.com. WiseFoodStorage.com offers delicious ready-made meals like cheesy lasagna, savory stroganoff, and pasta alfredo that are packaged for freshness in individual metal Mylar pouches and carry a 25-year shelf life, and they're ready to eat in minutes. Simply add hot water. Request a free entree sample today at WiseFoodStorage.com, and for a limited time, get free shipping and 10% off of your order. That's right, a free entree, free shipping, and 10% off any order. Just use promo code Lewis. Call 855-FOODWISE. That's 855-366-3947. Or visit WiseFoodStorage.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E, foodstorage.com. Gourmet emergency food at the best price and the greatest gift you can give to the ones you love this holiday season.
Big Berkey water filters are in high demand. Storable foods are also in high demand. BigBerkeyWaterFilters.com has always kept our focus on the Berkey water filter products, but increasingly, our customers have been asking for storable foods. After months of research, BigBerkeyWaterFilters.com now offers great-tasting, long-lasting, storable foods. These ready-to-eat meals are packed in airtight nitrogen pouches. All you do is just add water, and because they're sealed so well, they come with a 25-year shelf life. Combine our Berkey water filters, which are powerful enough to purify treated, untreated, or even stagnant pond water with our storable foods, and you have a winning combination. Remember, we offer free shipping on every order over $50, and GCN listeners receive 5% off all ceramic filter systems. Visit BigBerkeyWaterFilters.com or call 877-99-BERKEY. That's BigBerkeyWaterFilters.com or call 877-99-BERKEY today.
What nutrition are you missing that's leading to the four major diseases? Cancer, arthritis, heart disease, and Parkinson's. There are at least 80,000 medical studies that show a lack of the protein glutathione to be linked to cancer, heart disease, Parkinson's, macular degeneration, lung disease, digestive diseases, diabetes, Alzheimer's, ALS, rheumatoid arthritis, and lupus. In all, at least 68 diseases. What is the number one food by which your body is most empowered to increase its glutathione production? It is undamaged whey protein from grass-fed cows. One World Whey is truly the first undamaged whey protein. All other whey protein powders are damaged by heat, chemicals, and filtration. One World Whey is the most life-giving whey protein powder ever produced. Call 888-988-3325. That's 888-988-3325. Or visit oneworldwhey.com. That's oneworldwhey.com.
This is Leslie Kane, and I'm with the Coalition for Freedom of Information, and you are listening to the Paracast.
We have Jeff Danilek exploring the 1897 mystery of the airships with Gene and Chris on the Paracast. As we continue our exploration, I want to go just briefly segue back before we cover what Chris said to Aurora, Texas, because as I mentioned to Chris before you came on, we weren't talking about you behind your back, except in a very nice way, which isn't always the case on the Paracast. We have a reputation. But what I did mention was there was a guy, I don't know if he's still around, but back in the 70s, I think, a guy named Hayden C. Hughes. Remember him?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Tell us the story of Hayden Hughes and Aurora, Texas.
Now, isn't this, if I'm correct, this is the gentleman who believed that the parts of the airship that had crashed there supposedly were buried in a well on his property?
That's essentially it, yes.
Yeah, and then as he tried to clean out this well and he developed this really disfiguring sort of...
No, that wasn't it. He was claiming to the press that he found a burial site supposedly that contained a being from there. Okay.
Yeah, there actually was a stone and everything. And in the report at the time, they actually claimed that they found this burnt body in the wreckage, and then they gave it a Christian burial, which is interesting, in an unmarked grave at the Aurora Cemetery. And supposedly there was even a stone that was in place there for a while saying it, but it's since vanished. Nobody really has seen this stone in quite a few years. If it ever was there to begin with. Historians in the town have looked into the stories from that era, and they have discovered or believe that it was a attempt to bring attention to the town because it was being bypassed by the railroad, and it was losing a lot of its population. The city was in real serious straits. And so one of the reporters there made up this story, basically, a Dallas reporter, about this airship crash in an effort to bring attention to the area. And apparently it didn't really work at the time. The story didn't really come out as such until about the 70s when people kind of discovered it in sort of an offhanded way.
I'll give you the story, by the way. I found the original UPI release A grave in a small North Texas cemetery contains the body of an 1897 astronaut who was not an inhabitant of this world, according to the International UFO Bureau. That, by the way, is Hayden Hughes' organization. The group, which investigates unidentified flying objects, has already initiated legal proceedings to exhume the body and will go to court if necessary to open the grave, Director Hayden Hughes said. Now, obviously that didn't happen. Okay. He failed.
Yeah, he did.
But he got national publicity? Hey.
Oh, absolutely. And I don't understand how he could make that claim, you know, without a body in front of you, how you can declare that this thing is from another planet without any sort of physical evidence in front of you is a little bit disconcerting.
So can we assume then that Aurora, Texas is just somebody's figment of their imagination trying to get that publicity to get the railroad to come in?
I think that was a big part of it, yeah. You know, I've dealt with the UFO community, and I think there's some wonderful people who are out there doing some real research on this, but I also think
I hear a butt coming.
Group out there. You what?
I said I heard that butt coming.
However, there's a small group of people out there, I think, who are sensationalists, and they glom on to just about anything that is going to bolster their opinion that there are extraterrestrials all over the place. And so I think this is maybe one of those instances where people got caught up in the story. And then once you come out with it and go public with it, it's awfully hard to rescind it without looking foolish. And so you kind of dive in with both feet, you have nothing really to show for it, and you hope that people forget that you ever mentioned it, and of course they never do, and, you know, that kind of thing happens all the time.
Well, I guess Hayden Hughes is just a relic of history now, UFO history. I haven't heard anything about him since then. I think that was a pretty embarrassing episode, though.
Yeah, I suspect so, but the thing is that there's a lot of those kinds of people out there, and it's hard to work your way through the real science versus the sensationalism that the entire subject seems to attract with such regularity. So,
what do you think of the UFO Hunter segment on Aurora? I felt that it was quite humorous.
Well, you know, the UFO Hunters, they're nice guys and everything, but they have a particular agenda, and they really don't question stuff very well. They don't look for alternative explanations. They just say, well, see, this is what this guy said, so it must be true.
Now, by the way, we should mention that Chris had an encounter with the UFO Hunters people where he did a segment, and they basically did a geographical flame out there where events in Colorado suddenly occurred in Arizona.
Yeah, well, we won't get into that.
No, that's enough to be said, but basically his experience wasn't too pleasant. Obviously, this came across as a show in search of ratings, but only lasted a couple of years before it was canceled.
Yeah, and I think that if they would try to be a little more objective in some of these explorations, I think they'd get a wider viewing audience. You know, they're really pandering to the group that are already true believers. And just like the Ancient Aliens series, you know, these people already believe this stuff, and you're just kind of feeding into it. But if they would be more objective, I think you'd get more people interested in watching and seeing and making up their own mind. That's what you really want people to do.
I think you see that in the UFO field, the really core true believers who accept all the nonsense amount to maybe a few thousand people. And you can't expand interest in the subject if you cater to them. Now, we kind of straddle a lot of different universes here because we're on commercial radio, we're online, we're available in iTunes, and therefore we bring on people who have been in the field for many years, people a little bit more new, and our listeners run the gamut. Some have been exploring this thing from time immemorial, and then some. Others are new to the subject, and we kind of try to serve both masters. And so bringing you on, we're trying to get a realistic look of 1897. But before we get into more detail, and I think we'll just move away from Aurora, in more detail of the cases here, do you think anything in 1897 indicates the presence of something unknown, paranormal, ET, whatever?
Well, you know, I looked at that theory in my book, you know, the whole idea of extraterrestrials being an explanation. And the thing I noticed about these reports is that these things weren't doing anything very extraordinary. They weren't blasting out of, you know, out of space real quick. They weren't making any erratic maneuvers. They weren't doing anything that was very ET-like. which led me to believe that it probably was a more terrestrial vehicle. So to answer your question, I don't believe that any of these sightings had anything to do with extraterrestrials. That's not to say, however, that extraterrestrials weren't perhaps observing this entire event from orbit just to see what we're doing. But in terms of actually interfering, I don't believe so.
Isn't it also interesting in the UFO cases that the technology displayed by the UFOs always seems to be a step or two ahead of us, but that's it?
Well, you know, the most interesting example of that was the Betty Barney Hill story, where Betty described the inside of the spacecraft that she was supposedly abducted on board, and they were using a chart, their space map, if you will, that was on a roller. You should pull it down, and that was their map. And I thought, well, that's kind of an interesting old-school way of navigating, using your having your charts on a roller and just pulling them down with a string. It sounds as though people really kind of describe things in their own technological understanding and confusing that for high-tech, and it's really not. It's pretty low-tech. Most of the UFO stuff you see out there, you wonder, how could these UFOs manage to get all the way out here with such low technology?
Well, I kind of felt for a number of years that the so-called star map in the Barney and Betty Hill case was a put-up job. Whether the thing is real or not, that particular instance, star maps, ET, highly advanced, traveling across the stars to get to Earth, and they're using star maps, you wonder. Jeff Danilek joins us. We don't wonder about him. Sometimes Chris wonders about me, because you're in
the Paracast.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio?
Something more important.
Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Are you ready to order the official Paracast t-shirt? You asked, we answered. We're now taking orders for the official Paracast t-shirt. It comes in white, 100% cotton. The front of it features the same logo that we have on our community forums. On the back it says, separating signal from noise. To order the official Paracast t-shirt, here's all you have to do. Visit our new online store at store.theparacast.com. One more time, that's store.theparacast.com. You can use a major credit card to place your order for the official Paracast t-shirt.
Hey neighbors, we have one more thing to talk about, and that's more merchandise at the official Paracast store. We have hats, we have jackets, we even have a flip video camcorder customized with the Paracast logo at the official Paracast store. It's all now available at the official Paracast store, store.theparacast.com.
What happened, man? You used to be energetic, happy, and wow, did the ladies love you. Now, you fall asleep on the couch, irritable, and out of shape. Don't be that guy. Call now for a risk-free trial of Ageless Male, a natural supplement shown to raise testosterone by 50% and maintain healthy, normal levels. No injections, no appointments. With healthy testosterone levels, you can feel that energy again, that great outlook again, and yes, even a healthy sex drive. Right now, you can try Ageless Male risk-free. There's nothing to lose, guys. If you're a man who's noticed changes in your body, your mood, your sex life, call now for a risk-free trial of Ageless Male. Be the guy you used to be. Just call 1-888-246-0623. Don't wait another day. Just call 1-888-246-0623. Again, 1-888-246-0623.
Whatever winter activity you enjoy, from snowmobiling, snowshoeing, skiing, or camping, there's inherent danger that you may find yourself having to stay warm. Be ready with InstaFire, a revolutionary, safe, simple, and versatile fire starter. InstaFire is a patented blend of volcanic rock, wood pellets, and paraffin wax that gets a fire blazing in just minutes. InstaFire is self-sustaining fire that starts right on top of snow or water and even burns wet wood. Sound incredible? It is. Check it out at InstaFire.com, a must for any outdoor outdoor winter activity. Instafire Easily Lights with matches or flintlock lighters is environmentally friendly. Stores Easy is lightweight, comes in a variety of sizes, and starts at $1.25 for a single pack or only $59.95 for a 5-gallon pail with free shipping. Go to Instafire.com, spelled Instafire.com, or call 888-482-4868. That's 888-482-4868. Safe, simple, versatile. Instafire.
Folks, have you lost your power and wanted to simply flip a switch to get the lights back on? If so, this is going to be the most important message you'll ever hear, because there's never been a better time to get ready for the winter power outages ahead. Here's why. Solar power generators are now available from our friends at Solutions from Science, one of our oldest sponsors. Their emergency backup systems provide life-saving electrical power when you need it most. Unlike gas generators, a solar generator runs quietly, emits no fumes, and produces electricity from the sun. It's like having an electric power plant running quietly in your own home. Whether it's ice storms, brownouts, or blackouts, you'll never have to suffer through painful power outages again. When the power goes out this winter, you'll be ready with a solar power generator from Solutions from Science. Go to MySolarBackup.com for more information. That's MySolarBackup.com or call 877-327-0365.
Hi, this is Don Ecker, and you are tuned into the Paracast. Let me tell you what, you're going to hear stuff here that you probably won't hear anywhere else. Hear that, George Snorri?
Why does Chris worry about me? I think it's because, you know, he never knows what I'm going to do. I never tell him what I'm going to do. He has to just kind of take it and put up with it. And he accepts it with relative.
Thank you, sir. Calm. Can I have another?
That's right. You know, he just, no, I don't do that. We used to have a host where I never knew what was going to happen.
Getting back to your point about presage technology or precursor technology, now, most of our listeners are probably aware that, you know, solid, heavier than air dirigibles weren't invented for another 3 years, but the time frame is very, very close. I think Ferdinand von Zeppelin did his first maiden flight sometime in the summer of 1900, if memory serves me correct. But this is an example of just slightly ahead of our time technology being viewed as extraordinary because of its of the timing. But it also falls neatly into your suspicion that this could possibly have been very terrestrial technology that was being trotted out and field tested, basically. My only problem with that theory is why did those lawyers or whoever was behind this thing, why didn't they maximize the potential and beat von Zeppelin to the patent office, basically, and actually, you know, trot this technology out and do a big unveiling of it. I mean, there's something about that doesn't make sense.
Well, my premise is that's what they were actually doing was keeping it a secret while they were developing the technologies, testing it in these series of flights and short hops around California and then later in the Midwest, with the idea of eventually bringing it out to the East Coast and then unveiling it all at once. That way they would not have to worry about people stealing the patents. Remember, this is the time of Edison and Westinghouse. We're constantly stealing each other's ideas, trying to beat each other, the patent office. So this kind of thing happened quite a bit among inventors. There was a lot of theft. The Wright brothers were notorious for making sure that nobody had anything on their airplane that they had patented. You know, so I can understand why a person would want to keep it private. Once they were able to refine the technology and get it to the point where it was, you know, working reliably, then they could unveil it and get a lot of support at that point, a lot of people buying into it. The other thing I wanted to say real quick, though, is that airships had flown prior to this, back in the summer of 1885, two French engineers, Renard and Krebs, had built an airship called La France, which was a little electric-powered airship about 150 feet long, and they actually flew several times in this thing successfully. The idea that there wasn't any airships prior to 1897 simply isn't supported by history, and in fact is why I kind of went to this idea, because it seemed like it was the next logical step. After Renard and Krebs had proven the concept, it was a matter of simply refining the technology, more powerful engines, things like that, to make it more feasible. That's my premise.
Yeah, that's interesting. I had no idea that someone beat Von Zeppelin to the punch there. Well, here's another question for you. If you look through the accounts from the time, you'll notice that there's quite a wide variety of descriptions of these craft. How do you account for widely differing descriptions of what we're talking about as being a single or possibly two craft or something?
Well, I think that, like I said, a lot of the descriptions probably were erroneous. I think people got caught up in the fever of this thing. There was a lot of interest in it. People would see something in the sky, or sometimes just out-and-out make stuff up just to get in the paper. I mean, they had accounts from as far north as Canada, as far south as South Texas, and obviously this airship couldn't have been all over the Midwest. I mean, it just simply was not practical that it could. So a lot of these reports most likely are either wrong or hoaxes, and that would account for a lot of disparity. However, what's amazing about this is that there was a lot of agreement. Most people said this thing was up to 200 feet long and cigar-shaped. They would vary sometimes on whether it had one light or two lights or things like that. But as far as the general overall shape and description of the thing, most of them were pretty consistent.
So why do we want to find something mystical about it other than to say, hey, you know, conceivably these were early experiments in heavier-than-air flight?
Well, there's always the idea of not, you know, that not knowing is very attractive. There's something happened. It's a mystery. We don't know what it is. And people just find that to be fascinating. And so they come in and they want to fill in those gaps in our knowledge. I suspect that history is full of things that happened that we don't know about, that were the information was lost or the person got killed before they were able to reveal it. And we want to know these things. So when we get a mystery like 1897 airship, people want to fill in those blanks and make it into a bigger thing than it really is. Because if you think about it, if it really was just a guy who had invented an airship, that's not that exciting. But if you think it's a UFO or extraterrestrials or something like that, it suddenly becomes a much more exciting story.
All right. Was this particularly in the U.S. and Canada? Do we find airships around the world?
Well, interestingly, there are accounts of airships being seen in a lot of different places around the world during the 1800s. Some of these were probably erroneous reports, misrepresentations of the planet Venus or something like that. But it's hard to know. Like I said, things probably happened in history that we don't know about, and we never will, just because the information has been lost. So it's not at all amazing to me to think that some people out there in different countries may have had the same idea. After all, the airplane was being developed by people in different countries all over the world at about the same time. Most of them weren't even working together. They didn't even know about the other person, and they were coming up with a lot of the same ideas and concepts.
Was there a rush to be first with a successful invention, a successful aircraft, or were they, as you say, totally unaware of each other?
I think a lot of them were unaware. I mean, communications back then was very poor. Unless you really made an effort to find out what was going on in the world of aeronautics, it was easy to assume that nothing much was happening and you were starting from scratch. That's why you had so much redundancy in early aviation attempts, efforts, because people were duplicating the same thing, you know, inventing the wheel over and over again because they didn't know what anyone else was doing.
Just parenthetically, the Wright brothers, how close were other inventors to doing what they did?
There may have actually been a gentleman.
Yeah, really close.
Yeah, actually a couple of years before the Wright brothers, a gentleman named Gustav Whitehead had constructed a small monoplane. And there are people who believe, and I happen to be one of them, who believe that he actually was able to get this thing to fly for short distances as early as 1901. So the Wright brothers were the first. What they did differently is they recorded everything. They got photographs. They kept records. They had witnesses.
They were marketing experts.
A lot of the inventors worked. Yeah, you know, a lot of the inventors worked in private, in secret. They didn't want people to know what they were doing, and then nobody knew about it.
What about patent laws back in the late portions of the 19th century. Did we had a patent law in the United States, didn't we, or not?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, you could. People patented stuff all the way back to the...
Okay, so weren't there rights to one's inventions then?
Not unless you filed a patent and it was accepted.
Of course, we understand that.
Because some people didn't. I love the quote from the head of the patent office, and I think it was 1898, that don't bother trying anymore. Everything that can be invented has been invented.
Okay, let's just give it up and go home.
The futurist, wasn't he?
I have a question for Jeff here. Another really cool event that I uncovered in my research in the Rocky Mountain region was a very obscure, little-known event that was very well covered in the state of New Mexico. And it involves in 1880 an airship-type object, but in the shape of a fish, like a giant fish that landed near the town picnic of Galisteo, New Mexico in 1880. And a group of small diminutive beings got out and got into a terrible argument in some weird language and were yelling and screaming at each other. And they finally resolved the argument, you know, in front of these astonished townspeople, got back aboard their fish-shaped airship and took off. Have you ever heard of that one?
My research indicates that was a band of Italians.
That was a band of tiny Italians, young Italians.
Little Italians. Yeah, and they were just having a cool conversation. They were having a disagreement, and they got it worked out. So, you know, all is good in the end. But to answer your question, I've been slipping, I'm sorry. But, no, I'm not really familiar with this particular story. I would like to find out about that.
We'll have more stories.
Yeah, there were newspaper
more stories. So many more coming up in the subsequent hours here with Jeff Danilek as we return to 1897 and earlier, going back through time with Gene and Chris. You're in
the Paracast.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN. Great talk radio starts here.
Hi, this is Ted Anderson. If you own an Apple iPhone and love to listen to your favorite programs on GCN, I've got good news for you. I'm proud to announce that GCN has a brand new iPhone app available for our dedicated listeners at GCNlive.com. Listen to your favorite hard-hitting GCN programs live or on demand right on your iPhone. And the best part? The GCN iPhone app can be yours absolutely free. Download the iPhone app today by clicking on the banner at GCNlive.com. Again, that's GCNlive.com.
We the people grow cotton, weave fabric, engrave ink, embed strip and fibers to protect from counterfeit, then carting to a private bank, having it lent back at interest, forcing taxes to service debt. This capitalism, or was Jefferson correct when stating a central bank issuing the public currency is a greater menace to the liberties of the people than a standing army? Ted Anderson, I'm placing a free silver dollar in a book that explains our monetary system. Call for your copy, 800-686-2237. It's time to understand the system. Call 800-686-2237. That's 800-686-2237.